May it please the court, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, Justice Ridgely. Good afternoon. My name is Tim Lankick from the law firm of Young, Conaway, Stargate & Taylor. Before I begin my presentation, I would respectfully request that 5 minutes of my time be reserved for rebuttal.
That's fine.
Members of the court, the issue is relatively straightforward and narrow in this appeal, and that is, does the plain meaning of the Scottsdale policy exclude a claim for negligent control of an employee after that employee becomes intoxicated? The appellants submit that because the policy is absolutely silent in that regard, that the trial judge erred and that the decision below should be reversed. If I may briefly summarize the relevant facts, this case involves a bouncer who arrived to work at approximately 10 p.m. on a Friday night. The last call at the bar was 12:30. The bar closed at 1. The bouncer stayed at the bar until at least 2, maybe 2:15. The accident occurred at 2:45. There is no evidence below as to where, when, or how the bouncer became intoxicated. But if this case had proceeded to trial, the plaintiffs below retained the chief medical examiner, Dr. Callery, to offer expert opinion that Bankshots knew or should have known that their bouncer was 3 times the legal limit before he left the premises.
So was he working or not?
He was working.
He was working.
The victims in the underlying accident filed consolidated complaints alleging, among many other allegations, that Bankshots was independently liable for allowing its employee to leave in a grossly intoxicated state.
So, as I understand your argument, the Superior Court relied on this fundamentally premise analysis that started with Terra Nova, and you would like our court to reject that doctrine.
No, Justice Holland. The fundamental premises case, first of all, has not been applied directly by this court, by the Supreme Court.
Right.
It's been applied 3 or 4 times by the Superior Court.
Right, in Graves and the other cases.
I don't believe that it makes a difference whether or not it's applied.
The reason I ask the question is, and that seems to be the basis for the Superior Court's holding. So when we rule in your favor, what's your position with regard to what we should say about this fundamentally premised analysis? Because we would have to address it in reversing the Superior Court's opinion.
This court's opinion would begin and end with the plain meaning of the liquor liability exclusion. And the liquor liability exclusion is completely silent with regard to negligent control. In fact, the only poor decision I could locate from this court dealing with the fundamentally premised rule, rather than adopt that rule, this court actually looked to the assault and battery exclusion, and in that particular case, the assault and battery exclusion actually excluded negligent control and supervision. And so this court didn't reach the fundamentally premised rule. And I don't believe this court needs to because of the plain meaning. Whether or not the court decides to adopt that as the rule of Delaware, it shouldn't impact this because it's a plain meaning analysis, and the trial judge should have stopped there. Rather than stopping there, the trial judge analogized this case to the assault and battery cases. And it's the assault and battery cases where the fundamentally premised rule arose. The appellant's position is that the plain meaning, because it's completely silent, the trial judge erred by reading in to the exclusion the fundamentally premised rule, which is essentially what the trial judge did below. In the assault and battery cases, and I set forth this in my papers, all of the alleged negligent acts committed by the employer occurred before the excluded act. And let me give an example. The employer hires a bouncer who has a criminal record, has violent tendencies, is known to carry an illegal weapon, whatever, and somebody's injured on the premises. The injured party brings suit against the bouncer, and also brings suit against the employer and says, you guys, the employer didn't properly supervise or train the bouncer. Well, what the Superior Court in the fundamentally premised cases has held is that the failure to train a bouncer led to the assault and battery. And so the failure to train the bouncer is excluded because it preceded it.
Well, in this case, did the owner of the establishment cause or contribute to the intoxication of the bouncer?
Justice Holland, we don't know. We do not know how Mr. Stevens became intoxicated.
And you're not alleging that in your complaint?
We did. Well, before we filed suit, we alleged it. When we filed suit, we alleged it. But discovery, no one could tell us how it was that Mr. Stevens got to three times the legal limit.
Well, how do you allege it in your complaint if you don't have any facts to support it?
Because the circumstantial facts are he got there at 10 o'clock and he left at 2. And one could surmise that if he's 0.23, 45 minutes, half hour to 45 minutes later.
What is your point, that he may have brought a fifth of whiskey with him?
Possible.
But that's not what you... I'm sorry.
It's possible.
That's not what you alleged, though. Didn't you allege that Bankshot served alcoholic beverages to its employee? That's in paragraph 36.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we had a reasonable basis to bring those claims. But in discovery, no one that was working that night could point us to someone who saw Mr. Stevens drinking. So he could have been drinking a fifth of whiskey that he brought with him. He could have been helping himself to the bar when nobody was looking. So there's no
allowing
evidence.
Allowing him to do that would be contributing to his intoxication by the owner, wouldn't it?
Probably. Yeah. So going back to, let's apply the fundamentally premised rule to the facts of this case.
Well, why don't we just look at the language contributing to the intoxication of any person and take the facts as the pleadings indicated or as the status of the file at the time of summary judgment and forget about the fundamentally premised rule and explain to me why this exclusion doesn't apply.
Chief Justice,
I'm oversimplifying it, perhaps, but maybe that's
no,
the only way I can
no,
understand
I, no,
it.
No, I don't think so. I would submit that the court is charged with looking at the record as of the time the summary judgment motion is decided.
Right.
That's what the court needs to look at. Not 2 years ago when we filed suit. The policy itself says causing or contributing to the intoxication of any person, and that would arguably include the bouncer. The problem is that the policy does not then go on and say it also includes the negligent control of the bouncer. And because we don't know whether or not he was drinking in secret or being served, without that second part of the exclusion, excluding negligent control, the policy is silent. And the reason why we say that is because in the assault and battery exclusion, assault and batteries are excluded. And that includes failing to prevent or suppress them. But the assault and battery exclusion then goes on and says, and by the way, the negligent employment, investigation, supervision, reporting to the authorities, or retention of any person from whom any insured is or ever was legally responsible and whose conduct will be excluded by paragraphs 1, 2, 3, which talk about it, we're also disclaiming.
Let me go back to simplifying it.
Mm-hmm.
We're at the summary judgment stage, and based on the record that the trial judge is compelled to limit the basis for his decision to at the time, the simplest way to state your case is there was an undeveloped factual record that could have made it clear that this exclusion didn't apply because there could have been factual circumstances suggesting that there wasn't contribution by the owner to the intoxicated person, the bouncer. But where does that leave you?
Well, that is, Chief Justice, that is the burden of Scottsdale. It's Scottsdale's burden to prove that the exclusion applies. And I submit that part of that is that there has to be facts that Bankshot's caused or contributed to Mr. Stevens' intoxication. Now, I don't believe the court needs to go that far because I believe the court can look at the policy and sit it next to the assault and battery exclusion. And based on the plain meaning of the policy, it does not include the the negligent control allegations alleged in the complaint. Scottsdale knew how to draft it because they drafted it in the assault and battery, and they left the liquor liability exclusion as is.
Well, I guess where I'm lost is I'm having trouble following why not controlling the employee wouldn't be contributing to the intoxication of any person.
Because there's a separate cause of action that we alleged. An employer has a special relationship with its employees under Delaware law. And part of that is controlling your employees. And if you have an employee who's stumbling around your property at 0.23, as the chief medical examiner would have testified, you have an obligation to that employee and by extension to the public from preventing that employee from leaving. Whether or not he was drinking on his own in the bathroom or helping himself to the bar when nobody was looking. And so we're well beyond causing or contributing to the intoxication of Mr. Stevens when the bars closed at 1, last call was at 12:30. And from 1 to 2, Mr. Stevens is in that bar at least three times the legal limit because that's what he was at 2:45. And simply saying that causing or contributing to the intoxication would knock this out ignores the whole cause of action that exists under Delaware law for not controlling your employee, and which Scottsdale knew about because the assault and battery included it.
So if following that premise, if you prevail, what you're saying is if you're a business like McDonald's that doesn't serve any alcohol at all, but one of your employees becomes intoxicated, you have a duty to make sure they don't leave. Is that correct?
It would be correct, Your Honor, with one more thing. You knew or should have known that employee was intoxicated.
Well, let's suppose,
yes.
You know, it's mm-hmm. time to close up. They're closing up. They're clearly intoxicated. You're saying that even if you're not a person that serves alcoholic beverages, as an employer, you have this legal obligation not to let your employee who became intoxicated on their own leave.
That's correct, Your Honor. And there's cases throughout the country that deal with that.
Insurance companies cover kidnapping an employee, unlawful restraint of an employee. What's the imposition of the duty that would allow any rational employer to say to an employee who has no access to alcohol on the employer's principle, you can't leave because I, in my subjective judgment, believe that you're intoxicated?
Well, there are things that they can do. They can arrange for alternative transportation. They can take the employee home. And it's negligence, plain and simple, and it's for a fact finder to decide. And we're not going to have a trial in this case. And these arguments, while I agree they're relevant and interesting, should have been raised below, and they were not. But going back to
the legal duty to restrain an employee.
Not restrain, but do something to prevent him from leaving. There are cases, for example, where an employee pulled a couple extra shifts, and he leaves obviously fatigued and goes out and hurts somebody in an accident. There are cases that hold that the employer can be responsible if they knew the person was not fit to leave. It's similar to a trucking company that has a truck driver that has many, many moving violations, many, many prior accidents, doesn't get any remedial training, isn't suspended, disciplined at all, goes out there and hurts somebody. Under Delaware law, the trucking company there's a separate cause of action directly against the trucking company, different from respondeat superior. Another analogy would be if a physician, this is different, but if a physician has a patient that has epilepsy or a heart condition, doesn't tell the patient that. Patient
goes
out.
Let's go back to our case. One way to read the superior court's decision is that it was predicated on the assumption that bank shots had somehow been involved in serving the liquor that led to the intoxication, that it wasn't simply the employee getting it on his own. Is that the impression you get from the opinion?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, what the trial judge did was it lumped all of the allegations in the complaint and treated them as one, rather than breaking them out as we did into different counts.
All right, so then let's help us separate it out. If the scenario was bank shots served the liquor, then you could possibly understand why the Superior Court would get to the fundamentally premised analysis and look at the policy. But you're saying you had an entire separate allegation that assumed Bankshot had nothing to do with causing or contributing to the intoxication and was independently liable like McDonald's or anybody else would have been liable for letting an intoxicated employee leave.
No. No, the count wasn't pled that way. The count was just simply pled, and I believe the exact language was failure to control an already intoxicated employee by not arranging for alternative transportation or taking him home. But we never said, assuming he didn't become intoxicated as a result of Bankshot's negligence. We never were that specific because we didn't have those facts in front of us at the time.
So in the trial court's opinion on page 3, when the judge says the individual defendants assert that the tavern staff had served Stevens alcoholic beverages to the point of intoxication and then did not prevent him from leaving the tavern in his automobile, they also assert numerous other allegations of negligence. That's incorrect.
No, that is correct. That's a correct statement. What Justice Hahn was asking me was, did the complaint ever, in its separate count, did we ever allege that even if Bankshot didn't know Stevens was drinking on the job, they still had a separate duty? It was never broken out that cleanly because at the time of the complaint, discovery hadn't been done.
All right. But as I understand your position, by making him stay at the place of employment, his level of intoxication would go down, right? And then ultimately it would be safe for him to drive.
Sure. And in fact,
by not doing that, and he does leave intoxicated, is that what caused the intoxication at the time of the collision?
Well, we have a period of about a half an hour to 45 minutes between when he left the bar and when the accident happened.
That caused or contributed to him being intoxicated by not restraining him, for example. And if so, why isn't that subject of the exclusion?
No. No. Not holding him for an hour, an extra hour, didn't cause or contribute to his intoxication. He was already intoxicated.
But he would not be intoxicated if he left the next day because they said, you're going to stay right here. We got a cot for you right over here. He would not be intoxicated when he left. So by allowing him to leave, they basically permitted or caused the intoxication because he was in that condition as a result of leaving.
I'm not sure I understand your question, Justice Ridgely.
In terms of what you're saying the employer should have done, as a result of them not doing that, he left intoxicated.
Right, right.
So as a result of them not doing that, doesn't that mean that they caused that condition at that time? Not that they may have given him the drink.
I think that's probably an over-reading of the policy. This is standard language in commercial liability policies. It's dram shop. That's where it comes from.
Let me ask you this, to follow up on Justice Ridgely's question. On page 4 of the trial court's opinion, footnote 2 purports to set out all of the allegations asserted by the defendants about SB Shots, Inc.'s negligence. First, is that a correct and accurate summary of the allegations? And secondly, which of those are not fundamentally premised on the SB Shots, Inc. negligence in contributing to Stevens' intoxication?
Chief Justice, that was page 4, footnote 2.
That's the trial judge's understanding of the complaint or the defendant's allegations. First, is that accurate? And secondly, which of those are not fundamentally premised on SB Shots contributing to Stevens' intoxication?
Let me answer it this way. My time is running out.
I can give you all the time I need to get an answer.
Okay, great. It may be more helpful for me actually just to refer to the underlying complaint because this is a lengthy complaint. and then maybe
get, all right, why don't you save the balance of your time, and you can do that at your table, because I really am interested in the answer to that question, even if my colleagues may not be.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, Justice Ridgely. May it please the Court, Michael Galbraith on behalf of Appellee Scottsdale Insurance Company. At this time, I would like to introduce my co-counsel who will be arguing this matter, Mr. Thomas Crouch of Meir & Gear from Scottsdale, Arizona, whose admission has already been moved pro hoc vice. Thank you.
Welcome to the Court.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon. Thomas Crouch again for the appellee. Your Honor, my answer to your question is yes and none. Yes, that footnote 2 is an accurate representation of the claim pled, and none fall outside the fundamentally premised rule. I would suggest, I'm a little, I think this is an example of an attorney that pled a claim and then the claim wasn't covered, and is now, with all due respect, backing away from the claim that was plainly pled. When you go to the second amended complaint that's sitting right here in front of me, I could not have drafted a complaint that more clearly alleges a variety of negligent acts that are all fundamentally premised on causing or contributing to the intoxication of a person. I couldn't have done it. These allegations are... we see the term fundamentally premised or inextricably intertwined if we go to the Ted's Tavern case. These are inextricably intertwined. Negligence in serving alcohol to its employee, Albert P. Stevens, whose condition posed a risk to third parties through operation of motor vehicle. Failure to adequately supervise, monitor,
or
control.
We can leave it at the statement of the Superior Court judge on page 4 and footnote 2 is an accurate statement.
Yes.
We can follow those.
Yes. And the fundamentally premised rule, Justice Holland, you asked appellant, if we rule for you, or then are you asking us to essentially reject that? I was a little surprised by the answer. I think they would be asking you to reject that, and there's many reasons why you shouldn't reject that. While this court hasn't specifically ruled in a case and applied that, it did comment in the Graves case that was a proper reasoning or analysis by the lower court. It's been applied in several other Delaware law decisions, a federal court decision in Terra Nova and the Cosenza case, as well as the trial court's decision in Graves. There's many other cases around the country that apply the same reasoning, and you might ask, well, what's so significant about this reasoning? Well, the excluded risk here is not just the service of alcohol. It's the bodily injury that flows from this. At some point, every case is going to involve a third party on whom injury was inflicted by reason of the insured having caused or contributed to the intoxication of a person. And here, appellants have said, well, the negligent act after the intoxication is somehow separate and independent and on its own and therefore doesn't fall within the exclusion. But those courts following the proper analysis say, well, wait a minute, really each of these individual acts that you identify, they're all acts that simply lead to or allow the excluded event to happen. And so here, whether the particular negligent act occurred before the intoxication, for example, negligent hiring or training, or maybe during the intoxication, a manager negligently monitoring his staff or her staff when they're giving each other drinks, or after, negligent act after the intoxication in the form of some sort of control or imprisonment, if you will, any of those acts are all part of the sequence of events that leads to or allows the excluded risk. And the excluded risk, of course, is the bodily injury that occurs by reason of the insured having contributed or caused the intoxication of any person.
So going back to Justice Ridgely's earlier question, when we're talking about intoxication, the operative time is the time of the bodily injury. And to the extent the person was intoxicated at that time, if we look at this allegation of negligent control, the reason the person was causing the bodily injury in an intoxicated condition is because you didn't control them and allowed them to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And you relate that back to this fundamentally premised argument.
Yes, Your Honor. This fundamentally premised analysis also has sound reason, because you look at the Ted's Tavern case, and the analysis was borrowed by our trial judge here. There's kind of this notion that we don't want, like, creative pleading to circumvent what is a plainly applicable exclusion. And well, here,
but how do you respond to the suggestion that in this particular policy, the exclusions under battery are different, and the simple way to solve this problem is simply to take the control exclusion from the battery and repeat it, you know, here, and since it wasn't repeated here, it should be treated differently here.
Right. I couldn't articulate the response better than the trial court's the opinion, which is, we can't say because you had a specific word added to this exclusion over here, somehow we have to ignore the plain, broad language of the liquor liability exclusion. And, you know, the assault and battery exclusion kind of has its own history. ISO, the body that drafts these things, I think saw a couple of what I would call rogue decisions and decided to redraft that particular exclusion. But that doesn't, you know, saying that because you've got the supervision word over here, we're going to ignore what the plain language is, that wouldn't be a proper method of analysis. The last point I want to make in terms of the fundamental premise analysis, this independent separate act or negligent claim that is being identified as just this kind of broad, every employer has a duty to supervise its employees. And the appellants would kind of want to have this court say, well, yeah, there's a separate negligent supervision claim that already exists out there. But the question really is there a claim, a duty to prevent a person from leaving whose intoxication you've caused? And that claim, I don't think, exists in Delaware in light of the Shea decision that came down last year, where this court specifically looked at that exact type of claim. As a matter of fact,
Those are two different issues, though. One is a theory of liability. The other is whether you have insurance coverage.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I don't think this court has to decide in this case whether that claim exists or whether it should somehow back away from Shea. But I would refer the court to two Fifth Circuit decisions that tie this into coverage, okay, because the Kelly case and the Williams case both went through an analysis of where we have intoxication claimed by a third party, a liquor liability exclusion, and then the courts in those cases get to a similar allegation here. Well, we've got this separate negligence claim about preventing somebody from leaving. And the courts in those cases said, we've looked at the applicable law, and we don't think that claim even exists. So it certainly can't be some independent claim outside of the liquor liability exclusion.
But what about the truck driver who's unable to drive because he's too sleepy? That's an example of a claim.
You can hypothesize any number of failure to supervise type claims that don't involve alcohol. And you might say, well, we're going to recognize some claim here. But this case is about alcohol and drunk driving and restraining somebody. And to me, the Shea case made it very clear that Delaware has looked at this. This court has looked at this. It said this is a topic for the General Assembly. And until they create it, we're not going, or, you know, we're going to leave that decision for them. We're not going to create that claim.
But the distinction your opponent's trying to make is between patrons and employees. And that's, so we, to the extent we've dealt with the Shea issue many times, it's all been patrons who have been causing injury to third parties. What do you think of that attempted distinction?
Yeah, I think the public policy behind this is about alcohol and situations involving alcohol. And so the distinction between a patron or maybe a sibling, as was the case in Shea, it's immaterial to the question of whether that claim is going to exist or not. And then, of course,
but as you know, the argument we just heard is that this should apply to McDonald's or anybody, you know, that doesn't serve alcohol.
Yeah, but keep in mind the exclusion is not even going to apply to a business that doesn't serve alcohol. This provision is a standard provision in all general liability policies, and at the end of it, it says this only applies if you're in the business of furnishing alcohol. And the reason it's there is because businesses, bars, obviously face a heightened risk when they're dealing with alcohol.
So you're saying to the extent that McDonald's let somebody leave who was intoxicated, and there was a claim for negligent control or supervision, they'd have coverage.
If the claim existed.
Well, a duty to defend, then, at least.
Yes. But that's not this case. I'm just going to conclude by noting, you know, our position that the fundamentally premised analysis was applicable. It was correctly applied. All of the claims that are pled, and I would urge the court to simply.
Is that the function, the equivalent of inextricably intertwined, or are those different?
I think they're equivalent. The concept being, would the claim exist if there hadn't been the intoxication caused by the insured?
Is there?
And if the answer is no,
is
then
a
those
number of jurisdictions. Go use one phrase and a number use the other phrase? Or
I believe the Delaware courts are the only ones I saw using the fundamentally premised, those specific words. Ted's Tavern used inextricably intertwined. There's a number of other cases that may not have used those catchphrases, but their analysis was the same. The Sheffield and Cusenberry cases from Montana, Scarlett O'Hara case from Florida Court of Appeals, Paradigm Insurance Company from the Texas Court of Appeals, and then the Garina versus Scottsdale Insurance from the Southern District. Same method of analysis. You could use the term fundamentally premised to define it, or inextricably intertwined.
I don't have my Funkin' Wagnalls at the bench today, but it strikes me that fundamentally premise is much more focused and narrow than inextricably intertwined, which has always struck me as a bit of a weasel-worded phrase that allows you to incorporate anything into it you virtually want to, depending on how you want the case to turn out. Fundamentally premise is pretty narrowly and directly focused, wouldn't you say?
I think I would agree with that. Generally, that fundamentally premise does sound like you're focusing more, and courts have used that phrase a lot, and they seem to like it for some reason, and maybe it's allows a flexibility that they're comfortable with. But in this case, the analysis is, would the claim be here but for the intoxication caused? And if you say no, then it's premised on the intoxication. We would ask for affirmance. Thank you.
In response to Chief Justice's question, footnote 2 on paragraph 4 has a typo. The last sentence says, let me read the last three sentences, starting with Stevens. It says, Stevens, so as to prevent him from becoming intoxicated during his shift, so as to prevent him from becoming intoxicated during his shift. What the court meant to say was what I said in paragraph 34 of my complaint, which was that Bank Shots had a duty to the public and to the plaintiff to prevent Albert P. Stevens from driving a vehicle from Bank Shots after his shift concluded. So what that sentence at the last, the bottom of footnote 2, instead of repeating that language, it should say to prevent Albert P. Stevens from driving a vehicle from Bank Shots after his shift concluded. There are allegations in the complaint dealing with negligent control and specifically saying that they had an obligation to prevent him from leaving. That's covered in the complaint.
But don't they all say because they served him alcohol?
Justice Hahn, off the top of my head, I do not know if there's a separate one. But there's the catch-all was otherwise negligent and grossly negligent. And somewhere in the complaint, we allege that they could have rearranged for alternate transportation or something like that.
Well, my question, I don't have it in front of me, but my recollection is the allegations in the complaint were Bank Shots served him alcohol and should not have let him drive. Bank Shots served him alcohol, they should not have let him leave. Bank Shots served him alcohol, and whatever it is you attribute to failure to supervise, failure to control follows. They served him alcohol.
That's right.
But even if we focus solely on the preventing from leaving, isn't it accurate to say that by failing to prevent him from leaving, Bank Shots contributed to his intoxication at the time of the collision?
No, again, I think that's an over-reading of the language. Contributing to the intoxication.
Set aside the language. Is that accurate as a matter of fact?
We don't know. Because the people who were there that night couldn't offer any testimony that they saw him drinking.
Okay. Thank you very much, counsel. Take the case under advisement and recess.
Thank you.